Hello, welcome to another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Jeff, how are you today?
I'm wonderful, Sal. How are you?
Outstanding.
That's awesome.
We have a special guest in the podcast room with us this morning.
We do. We've got a dignitary with us today.
It is.
Oh, boy.
I tell you. He's all right. I watch people out there. He's been out there in the foyer, and people are coming up and shaking his hand. You'd think it was the governor in here.
Hardly.
We have Bruce Kettler, the president of the Agribusiness Council of Indiana. And Bruce, before we get started, the most important thing and everybody's favorite, we have to ask the question of the day. And you, because you're a dignitary, get a softball question.
Thank you. I'll appreciate that.
Yes. So what is your favorite vacation spot?
Well, this was interesting. When I like this one. This is a good one.
Makes you to a happy place, right?
It really does. Absolutely does. So, you know, when I was growing up, we didn't do much in the way of vacation. I think that was probably fairly normal. It was just part of how it was. But I have tried over the years for my wife and I have said, you know, we're going to try to do some vacations on a reasonably regular basis, and especially with family. And we have, I will say, and we've been, you know, fairly consistent with that. So probably my favorite, though, is in the Cayman Islands.
Wow.
Now, we haven't always done that. Don't do that every year. We have taken the family a couple of times, but it's special for not only for family, but for my wife and I. It's actually where we went on our honeymoon years and years ago, I mean, 35, 6 years ago. So Cayman Islands were very different then than they are now. It's a little more commercialized, a lot more resorts and hotels. But we have been able to take our family there. We've been blessed to be able to do that a time or two with family, and that's my favorite spot. It's really neat. You know, 7 Mile Beach in particular, where we have stayed, is just a pretty fascinating. The water's calm, it's blue. You can snorkel off the shore in not too deep a water, but yet you can see some fish and so forth. So it's a pretty favorite spot for me, and particularly for me and my wife. But our family's enjoyed it too.
Have you been there back pretty regularly? Or I know it's maybe not every year, but
yeah. So we haven't been there now for probably 5-6 years, I would say. But we did, we were able to do it a couple of times, prior to that. I'd like to go back. Plus I think two times we were there, I had my older sister actually lived in the Caymans for like 7 or 8 years. She worked at a big resort, and she was doing flowers. She had been in the floral business on her own for a number of years, lived in Florida for a lot of years, happened to end up in the Cayman Islands. So it was nice. We had her down there to visit a time or two
That would be nice.
Yeah, it was pretty neat. And she's back now, but her work visas kind of ran out over a period of time. But it's a beautiful place. The people are wonderful. The food is awesome. And you know, they basically speak English for the most part. And so it's easy to communicate. You just have to, the challenge is if you're going to drive a car, and I have managed to do it, it's like the UK, you're running on the opposite side of the road. And so you have to get used to that, but that makes it fun. But we've just had a lot of great times with, my wife and I, again, going back to our honeymoon and being able to take family there has been a lot of fun.
You're neat.
That's neat.
All right.
Sal?
Well, interestingly enough, I think mine would probably be where my wife and I went on our honeymoon, and we have been back several times, and it's a simple trip. It's an easy trip, but Gatlinburg. Mm-hmm. And it's not so much that there's things to do there, but it's one, it's drivable.
Sure. You know,
we can get there. We can drive down, and it's a nice drive down. But If I'm at home, which I'd rather, most times I'd rather go burn a brush pile or something like that, right? I'd certainly rather do that than go to the beach. But if I'm at home, I'll do something, or I won't stop.
Yep.
And we'll go until it's like we're exhausted, and then we get cleaned up, and then it's evening. But what we found is at Gatlinburg, we'll get a beautiful cabin, and we stop, and we'll play board games, or we'll play air hockey. The last cabin we was at had air hockey in there, and theater rooms. I don't hardly sit down and watch movies anymore, but if you have a theater room,
yeah,
you know, you're more likely to do that. But, and there's shows and things like that, but we've noticed changes too over the years. The crowd, oh my goodness, how much more crowded it is. But again, if you're kind of in the cabin and kind of doing your thing and nothing planned in the mornings, it's really relaxing.
Yeah.
That's what we found.
Great.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Jeff?
I'm not a beach guy.
No.
Much to my wife's dismay. I just, you know, I get to the beach and it's like, okay, 30 minutes later, what are we going to do now? Because it's like, I can't just lay here. And my best vacations, looking back, have been where we've gone out west to the mountains. And probably the best one we took, and especially with having a large family. So having seven kids, it's an ordeal to travel.
But, you have a big station wagon, the big wood panel station wagon.
That's what we need. But probably the best one we did, we went to a dude ranch out in Wyoming. And it's called Eaton's Ranch. Give them a shameless plug there. But went out there, went with another family and their kids, and we had a blast.
Really?
Yeah, all the kids had a blast.
How old were they when you went?
Oh, gosh, probably from that time, they were probably from, you know, youngest one was probably 3, and the oldest one would have been, you know, 18 or 19. And it was great. There was just, I mean, there's no cell coverage. Riding horses and just playing and running around, and it was awesome.
You all don't have horses though, do you?
That was the thing. At the time, we did have horses.
Oh, you did?
And I'm like, you know, we went out west to pay to ride somebody else's horses. I've got horses at home that aren't getting ridden, so it made perfect sense. So
yeah, sure.
I think they made a movie about a dude ranch, didn't they? It was a big cattle drive. That was back in the 80s or 90s.
I'm sure they did.
I have to think of that.
You just said you didn't watch movies. It must have been that media room you were in Gatlinburg.
No, it was in color. I remember that.
That's good.
Oh, well, Bruce, tell us a little bit about the kind of current events with the Agribusiness Council of Indiana.
We really need to get his introduction first.
Well, we should get
the introduction, kind of get your pedigree.
You've been on before, but you are an interesting person in the industry.
Well, that's kind of like you putting interesting in quotes. And
no, I didn't air quote it. Although Thomas kind of gave me he kind of looked up when I said that.
Well, Thad, a little bit about my background. I grew up West Central Ohio, originally from there, but have lived in Indiana basically since 1996 now, with the exception of a couple of years.
Every once in a while, we let a Buckeye slip across the border.
I found the hole in the fence or something, I guess, to
that
be able
whole
to get
immigration
through.
Thing.
Yeah, yeah, got to watch then. It. So, but Indiana is home, of course. Now we've been here long enough, but grew up there. My father actually worked in retail, and I've shared over the years that I think that's one of the, it's certainly one of the things that allowed me to appreciate agriculture at a very young age. He, you know, understanding the long hours and what's involved and sales and that. I'm actually an agronomist by training. So I think, again, that probably led me to say, you know, this is a pretty interesting field to be able to get into. And so started out with, I worked for almost 17 years with, was Dow Ag, went through the Dow Elanco joint venture, the Dow AgriSciences world for nearly 17 years. Was actually out of agriculture for a couple years after that, but I missed agriculture, really, really missed it in a big way. I just missed the interaction, the people was a big part of that. We had been to Memphis, Tennessee for a couple of years and came back, and that's when I was outside of ag. But we're living in central Indiana in Westfield, where we are today. That's when I went to work in the seed business, went to work for Beck's Hybrids. My wife actually was working for the National FFA Foundation at the time and said, hey, there's this company north of town that, you know, is a seed company she had become familiar with, and said, you ought to see if there's some opportunities there, because she knew I wanted to get back into agriculture. So worked at Beck's for 11 years. Then that's when I went to the State Department of Agriculture, spent 5 years there. That was another one of those unexpected things that, you know, you don't necessarily say when you're younger, I think I'm going to do that. That was not on my list of opportunities, but it was a great opportunity. I loved the role, loved the job, being able to experience, this state's agriculture in a very, just different way was pretty neat. And then came to Agribusiness Council of Indiana just under 2 years ago now. So
very good.
Yeah, a lot of different experiences. They've all been great, and I've loved every minute of it.
It's a neat transition for you, because going from State Department of Ag to the Agribusiness Council, it's almost like you're dealing with a lot of the same folks that
yes.
you've been networking with anyway.
Yeah, I absolutely have. And I think that's one of the things I've really enjoyed about my career is the opportunities and different companies and people that I've met with. You find out pretty quickly, as I think anybody that's been in agriculture for any period of time, is agriculture can be a pretty small group of folks. But they're great people typically, and you know, you just want to see the industry grow and prosper, and that was one of the reasons I think this fit with ACI was really good too, and to be able to get back into the opportunity outside of state government. I mean, people that I've talked to, and my own experience was it really is a different experience. One that I enjoyed, but to be able to get back more in toward the private sector was also a really good opportunity, and to be able to share what this industry and the people like Premier, the companies and people like Premier that support our farmers and what they do, very often I think is they're kind of lost. And that, again, agriculture, sometimes we tend to want to put our head down and just kind of say, leave us alone. But the people that support, sell, supply farmers, buy the product and the produce from farmers, very often they're the same way. Yeah. And I think we've got to tell our story better. And this to me was an opportunity to do that, in addition to, you know, kind of the policy efforts that we all have to work on at the state and federal level as well.
Very good. Well, you say agribusiness, and we think of, you know, kind of like ag retail of some sort or distribution, but a lot of the same issues, whether they're policy issues or whether they're just the environment, are the same as
right.
the growers.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
So what's kind of top of mind for the Agribusiness Council of Indiana right now in 24?
Yeah. So our policy efforts at ACI really mostly focus at the state level. Now we do interact certainly at the federal level, or watch what's happening at the federal level. A lot of our policy work and coordination at the federal level would be through various organizations that I'm sure Premier is a member of too. But think about organizations like the National Grain and Feed Association, the Ag Retailers Association, Fertilizer Institute, American Seed Trade Association. They're based in D.C. They're focused on federal policy efforts, but we coordinate as an organization with them, even though we'll focus mostly on state policy efforts. So at the state level, you know, certainly watching all of those sectors of the industry that we represent, in 2024, even kind of going back to 2023 at the Indiana State House, those efforts, there were a lot of things. The State Chemist Office, who of course is the regulatory body for fertilizer, crop protection products and in the state of Indiana, feed to a degree in the state of Indiana. There was a lot of scrutiny on State Chemist Office. The legislature in Indiana the last several years has said, hey, we want to make sure we're watching state agencies. They want a little more, I won't say control, but I think oversight is a good way to put it, of state agencies. So In this case, the Department of Environmental Management, Department of Natural Resources, and State Chemist Office kind of got, in particular, I think were kind of looked at. That started in 23, it continued into 24, so into the 24 session early this year. And really what came out of it and how it affected the State Chemist Office in particular. And this was an area we were watching as an organization pretty closely. We spent a lot of time in the State House and educating legislators on it. But what really drove it was the legislature said, we don't want state agencies to be any more restrictive on their regulations, rules, whatever that looked like, than the federal, than the feds. Which, okay, I think we can all say, okay, that maybe makes sense. But it did change some things with the State Chemist Office, particularly around pesticides, around training. And so we had to do some education of some folks on that because, for the most part, they did. The second thing that happened was there were a lot of over the years the State Chemist Office on pesticides, to a degree on fertilizer, had done a lot of rulemaking. And again, organizations like ours, and you know, retail organizations like Premier, have weighed in on that, have looked at that. But one of the things the legislature didn't particularly care for is if agencies had a number of rules and that weren't in statute, in other words, they weren't in the weren't legislatively passed, they were looking at those very closely. So State Chemist Office for 24 basically looked at a lot of the rules, things that were in their rules, and said, okay, we have to evaluate. One, is it more restrictive than maybe the US EPA, for example? And if so, we need to either dial it back or figure out how to change it. And then two, they put a lot of the rules, the things that were previously in rule, into the statute. And so that effort that gave, I think, then the legislature said, okay, that's much more transparent, they felt, than rulemaking. So we spent a lot of time on that. The other thing in 24 that we worked on, some of the land use things around agriculture. If you remember, there was some studies done that in 23, the State Department of Agriculture was required by the legislature to do a review of how much ag land was lost in the state of Indiana. So they went back about 10 years and did an evaluation of that. Of course, some of this stemmed out of things like solar projects. And so there was a little bit of, I won't say scrutiny, there was an effort to say, okay, we know we're losing ag land. What has it gone to? What do we as a legislature need to consider for that? So there were some ag land use things that were looked at. I don't think that'll go away. The study was released by the State Department of Agriture in July.
What drove that, Bruce? I mean, what, obviously, you know, when you see, solar panels, right. And no matter where you're at on the pros or cons, one thing we can all agree on, even if you don't know, it's just the fact is that once a ground is out of production, whether you put a warehouse on it or a solar power field or something else,
houses,
it will not be used for growing food, feed, or fiber again. And that's one of the things. Is that what generated the oversight concerns? Or what?
I think solar, to a degree, the solar activity in Indiana that has ramped up the last couple of years was part of it. My own opinion is there was another thing that happened that added to it, and that was the IEDC, the Indiana Economic Development Corporation, and the LEAP district that occurred up in Boone County. This is where the IEDC basically went in and purchased a lot of land and said, we're going to have an innovation district, a manufacturing district. They bought a lot of land. So I think if you take the solar what was going on with solar around the state, some of the big projects that were announced. Then you had that district, the leak district that was introduced up in Boone County. I think between those
pretty
two things,
legislators start connecting things.
That's and like, exactly right.
Hey, that happened down here.
That's exactly
right. Oh, this is what we've got
going exactly
on.
Right. Oh, and then,
and we
then
didn't
you
have
look
a baseline.
Pardon?
We really didn't have a baseline to know how fast we were losing farmland.
That's true.
That's exactly right. And that that was part of the impetus then, Jeff, for the study to say the Department of Ag, okay, we know we're losing land. We can all look around big cities or whatever and see
urban
warehouses,
sprawl.
The urban sprawl is a better way to put it. We can see that's happening. We know that a lot of that is coming out of agriculture land, but we don't know what it looks like. And so I don't think most people in agriculture certainly weren't offended by having a study that said, what are we losing?
Right.
And basically what we found is that I think that started in, if I remember right, the 2012, I think they were able to go back like 10 or 12 years. They looked, and what they did was they looked at tax rolls and how, so Director Lamb would tell you it's not exact. It probably how it's assessed and so forth probably differs a little bit from county to county to a degree, but it does establish somewhat of a baseline. So basically what we found was in the previous 10 or 12 years, we've lost about 350,000 acres of farmland
wow.
in the state of Indiana. And so it's now we do have that baseline.
In a decade.
In a decade, roughly. Yes. I think it was really, 10 to 12 years. So, that probably leads. We probably need to do that study at least every 5 years, I think. I think Director Lamb would say we probably need to do it maybe even a little more often than that. But we at least have a way of being able to capture some of that and look at that. We can argue if it's been assessed differently. That's probably not going to make a big difference. But yeah, you start to look. Indiana has roughly 11 million acres of if you just look at cropland, roughly we have about 11 million acres of cropland. You throw in the forest and the hardwoods and the other things that we have, it's more like probably 15 or 16, but it's not a small number.
Wow.
Well, and now I guess you could actually quantify, so if you put let's keep picking on solar farms. Let's say you put a solar farm in and you take those acres, what's the tax implication mm-hmm. from property taxes or is the solar farm, do they get a tax break or any business coming in that
right.
takes production ground out? Now these economic development, what you want to talk about for the county?
Corporations.
Yeah, your economic development, committees can actually assess now, here's what we get off an acre of farm ground. If we give that up, what are we going to gain, or should we give a tax abatement? So I think it's good.
That's right. And actually, as an outgrowth of that, I know there are some of the ag groups are now looking, and actually there is a study being done to say, okay, what is the value of agriculture land, of farmland? What is the long-term value?
What's the economic impact?
What is the impact? And the idea behind that is now that we have some acres, we can assess that. But then it does allow economic development groups or counties, county councils, county mm-hmm. commissioners, whatever, to make then an assessment of that value. People in agriculture aren't saying that growth and economic activity and development is necessarily bad, but you do need to make, there are trade-offs and we need to understand what those trade-offs are. So, to your point, Jeff, a solar field or, if we're taking 20, 25, 30 acres out to put up a big warehouse somewhere, what is the trade-off? Because the challenge, when I was at the State Department of Agriculture, what was always intriguing to me is to talk to particularly local, but even a lot of economic development folks. They didn't look at farmland and agriculture and frankly businesses like our ACI members. They didn't tend to look at them as having an economic impact in their communities. Well, look at any farm in any rural community, and they are there are, in many cases, you know, those farms surrounding even the smallest of small towns are the economic drivers for those folks.
A lot of times it's the only business.
And very often. But people don't tend to see farms as businesses. And that was a challenge. And so that's where, again, I think this study then to determine what is the value of agriculture land to a community or a county or whatever will be important to do, because then it allows us to make informed decisions of those trade-offs.
That's amazing. I'm glad we got that work going, because I'm like, Jeff, we need to know.
Yes.
You have to have a baseline.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think not only for the farms, but, you know, for companies like yours, where you can say to your, you know, you're across a lot of counties, or as you're talking to a legislator, you know, our farmers, this is the impact that our farmers have. And because of what they do, we as a company can sell fuel, sell fertilizer, sell crop protection, whatever that might be. And here's the reason we have to employ the people that we do in these communities and make that connection that a farm is a business, you know, a company like Premier is a business as well. And we do have an impact. That ground that we service and work on, that farmland, is not just waiting to be developed. And that's unfortunately, there's an attitude that farmland is just something waiting for a better economic opportunity.
A warehouse.
And
a McDonald's parking lot.
Yeah, you know, we can't look at farm ground as something that's just waiting to be developed for a better opportunity. It has value.
Corn is not just a placeholder.
That's right.
So, I think, and I can't remember, maybe you got the numbers. I think Director Lamb had these numbers. The amount of exports, of farm exports from Indiana, we ranked higher than I thought we would.
Yeah, I think if I remember the number, we're like probably the eighth largest exporter in terms of agriculture goods.
Yes, coming from Indiana. Yeah, I thought that was a...
It is. It's pretty amazing. But
considering
it goes back. Yes, exactly. But it's, again, it's more than corn and soybeans. We export a lot of that. But then when you start to think about the livestock, feeding corn and soybeans to livestock, and we export a lot of pork, we export a lot of poultry, you know, there's just a lot of goods that we continue to add value to what we do produce in the state of Indiana. And because of that, we can export a lot of products as well.
Yeah, I think those are important numbers that I think we need to share to make people start to recognize that, hey, agriculture, we are a real business. And we pay a lot of the bills that, you know, keep Indiana churning every
day.
So.
Absolutely.
Well, that's a good segue into... kind of another topic is I don't know how long it's been, but the Agribusiness Council of Indiana started an emerging professionals leadership program. And tell us a little bit about that, because I think that's kind of to make sure that we have younger folks that are going to be in leadership positions. Like you said that you never thought that you would be director of agriculture, right? I mean, that's something that, but you ended up, they need to be prepared and have the exposure to be able someday to assume these leadership roles. So tell us a little bit about that program.
Yeah. So this is a program that we say it's primarily aimed at early career professionals, though that can be a little bit of a misnomer. We would get what I would consider some mid-career folks as well. And a couple of them that I'm aware of that are maybe mid-career that were in the program probably had a change in terms of they were elevated into a different role within their organization, maybe started managing people when they had not before. So the Emerging Professionals Leadership Program, EPLP for short, is a program aimed at those early to mid-career folks within ACI members. And what we're really trying to do is a couple things. One, particularly if they're early career, they may not be very familiar with all the different sectors that agriculture covers. And, you know, again, our members are in grain, feed, seed, fertilizer, crop protection, you know, affiliated industries, whether it's banking, what have you. And so the idea here is to let's expose them to these different sectors because they may not be familiar. They may, let's say, for example, Premier's got two folks in this year's class that work primarily in the agronomy area, but they may not be super familiar with feed and livestock and how that works, or may not be real familiar with how the seed industry works. And so part of our effort here is it's a year-long program, and we basically spend a day, sometimes a day and a half, talking about these different sectors. And we'll move around the state of Indiana so they get exposed to different parts of the state. We'll talk, we'll do a little bit of a deep dive. We start out kind of high, get in a little bit of a deep dive on that sector and how it works, how it operates, what's the size of it in the state of Indiana, how does it impact the other areas of a business, and allow them to do that. Then throughout this, we also weave in, again, we mentioned earlier, we work on policy. So we start to talk about policy implications for that sector. And what does that mean? How regulations work or don't work. And so then the idea there being, as these people grow, develop, become leaders within their companies and organizations, they understand the implication of policy. Now, policy, not everything, but policy at the state and federal level is probably driving a lot more things that are happening to a business than most people realize. And I think when we put them through this program, they start to understand that a little bit better and what we do. We actually started something new with this year's class related to policy. We broke them up into small groups and said, okay, this was all really leading toward the trip going to Washington, D.C. to discuss federal policy. But research as small groups by sector, so we just assigned them to a sector, and in small groups, research policy implications or regulations that are happening or maybe have happened in the past that have been influential in that sector. And then think about, should ACI support that policy? Should ACI be against that policy? And so we're weaving this year, starting this year particularly, weaving some policy work into each of those sessions that they do. And it's been good. Again, not that policy drives everything, but we want them to understand that there are outside influences that do affect a business. And no matter what sector you're working in, you're going to have something that comes to you that's going to affect you, whether it's a legislative work. You talked earlier, Waters of the U.S. as an example, or is it rules and regulations that are coming down at the state and federal level that might impact as well?
Yeah, as businesses have to comply.
Yes.
Right, with the, whether it's safety or obviously we all want cleaner air, we all want cleaner water, we want safer environments, but those all come with a cost.
They do.
And we should, back to what Jeff said, we should know what they are.
Absolutely.
And how to measure it.
How many people do you have in that program?
So basically we this year's class is 24. In the past, ACI basically said, okay, about 25 people. If we got 26, we'd probably be okay. There is an application process, so it's not an automatic. We just want to make sure a couple things. One, that that they're in fact working in that with that company. We want the company to support the efforts because they're not. I mean, we've got nine sessions, so they're going to be away from work. Sure. For at least a day, sometimes a day and a half, in the case of going to Washington, D.C. for 2 days. So we want the employer to make sure they're supportive of that as well. We want a sponsor at that employer to be aware of that. So that's the reason for an application process as well. So roughly 25, it's a good sized group. They get to know each other that way, and we pick them across our membership, different size companies, all these different sectors. We try to get a really good mix so that they learn from each other as well. And when they go through it, so it's a great program, and I'm just really pleased that ACI has been able to, step it up and make it even stronger over the years.
I was kind of looking a little bit, Jeff, about some of the things that the group has done this year. They've been to the State House, Huntington University, and toured a fertilizer facility up there. They went down to CGB in Jeffersonville, and that's always an interesting
absolutely
area. They went to Superior Ag to a feed mill, and one of the attendees, Evan, said that that was fascinating. And matter of fact, I had shot an email to, not the name drop, but Alan Lowe. I was going to look for another guest when we record the next time.
And yeah,
just talk about the Food Safety and Modernization Act and yes, the impacts of that. Then they were up at another ag retailer up north, Washington, D.C., Remington, Indiana, for seed corn production. And then I think you're going to have some wrap-ups in the ACI office.
We do. We have a wrap-up coming up here in a month or so, and really just a way to kind of close this all out. One of the other things we do, every session, we do a leadership development effort. My counterpart, Jen Weldon, has selected a leadership book that they read throughout the year. So basically take it in sections and talk about it. We spend at least an hour, sometimes even more, of every session going through that book, talking about leadership and what this author has proposed. And then it allows them to interact. Because what we found too, not all, but a lot of these folks are also managing people or starting to manage people in their organizations. And over the years, that's happening at a younger age for a lot of people. And so many times they're first time managers of people. So you've all of a sudden you've got responsibilities, including people. And, you know, what does that look like? And so this interaction in talking about the leadership book has been a lot of fun too. And, you know, for me, as I've looked back now, the last couple of years I've been here, I think one of the most valuable things this program does, besides the learning of particular sectors, it's creating a network for these young people.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all want them to stay in this industry for a long time. And if you do that, kind of back to what we talked about earlier, you know, you meet people over the years, you may lose touch with them out of different roles, but having that network to be able to share with, or, you know, if I'm an employee at Premier and I'm managing people and maybe I've got something I'm not sure exactly how to work out, I can go to somebody else, maybe in another company, another sector, and say, how would you handle this? And that network that we're helping them develop is so critical. You know, I'm sure I was the same way. I probably didn't understand the value of a network when I started in this industry, but boy, over the years, it becomes pretty important. And so developing that network and leadership capability is really critical, I think.
You know, I think the ag industry probably, as an industry, does that networking thing better than any other industry out there. And that's it is critical. And I think the quicker we get these young people plugged into that network and get them to start realizing the benefits that can have to them and their businesses down the road, I think the better off we are.
I agree. You know, and, you know, if they've gone to even a, you know, if they've gone to a 2-year college or a 4-year college, there's not a lot of that taught. And it's tough to teach, okay? Mm-hmm. You sometimes you just have to experience it. And I think that's what we're able to do with the EPA LP program is we can teach about leadership and concepts and theories in a book, but then they can experience that networking on their own. And it's really fun to watch a new class from the time they're together for their first time until now, you know, essentially a year later, 9 sessions. It's really fun to watch the dynamics of this group change, and it changes a lot. And that's a good thing.
That's neat.
Yeah, that's you talk about the network. My wife always jokes that we can't walk through an airport without running into somebody we know. Yeah. So it's a cool industry to be in.
Absolutely,
I think that networking thing is so important.
Really is.
Good.
Yeah.
I mean, Sal and I actually used to work for the same company.
I know.
You know. Now here we are back together. It's like getting the band back together.
It is a small industry, and it's I remember when I was about the same time frame, whenever Jeff was getting that phone installed in the trunk of his car, I was one of the young kids at the meetings back in the Terra days. And I'm looking around the room and I'm like, how do these guys know each other? You know? Yeah. And now
now you know.
Now I know.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's important. It really is.
Bruce, is there anything else about the Agribusiness Council that we didn't cover that we want to make sure we touch on?
You know, we continue to, we want to actually bring in new members. We're always looking for new members. So we're kind of, you know, ag tech is an area that we're looking at. Some of the companies that are coming into the biological product spaces are kind of some focuses that we're doing. So we're always looking for new members and doing that. We'll continue the policy work. I think it's safe to say that the State House legislative session this year is going to be pretty interesting. There's a lot of things changing. We're going to have a new governor. We know we're going to have a new administration. It's a budget year. Taxes are, you know, probably going to be talked about. We specifically and other ag groups are working on potential changes in legislation for the grain buyers and warehouse licensing agencies. So for the folks in the feed and the grain sector, we're working already, have been working for months on some potential adjustments and changes there. So we expect a busy session. It's there's always something, and there will be surprises. There always are every year. So we'll continue to do that work.
And any ag businesses that want to reach out to check with membership and see what that's about, they can find that on the website.
They can find it on the Agribusiness Council website. We'd love to have that. My contact information is there. Always glad to be able to talk to folks as well.
All right, Jeff. Anything else?
No, I think ACI is doing a lot of great work, and we appreciate your time.
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
All right. Well, that's another episode of The High Ground, powered by Premier Companies. Please like and subscribe. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.